I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, violent surges in Iraq prior to elections. A mild reaction to the Palestinian prime minister resigning. Syria may be a unifying issue for Israel and Turkey.
This is one area in the region where the two countries have quite overlapping interests.
And Egyptians want, but are wary of, an IMF loan. It's all ahead. Bombings and other attacks across Iraq have killed at least 20 people and wounded nearly 200 others. The violence today hit the capital, Baghdad, as well as Kirkuk and Tuz Kermato to the north, the central city of Samarra, and Nasiriyah in southern Iraq. We spoke about the violence with Middle East analyst Jim Phillips of the Heritage Foundation.
Well, I think this is probably many of these explosions tied into al-Qaeda in Iraq, which seeks to disrupt the elections which are coming up, I think, on Saturday, the first elections held in Iraq since the U.S. withdrawal.
What is your feeling about the elections?
Hopefully, the elections will provide openings for new political blood that can work out effective compromises between Iraq's many political, social, and ethnic religious groups in order to ease the strain of government in a country that is really a mosaic of different factions.
Are you optimistic that might happen?
I think in the long run I'm optimistic, but in the short run, as long as the sectarian bloodletting next door in Syria is going on, I think that's going to intensify tensions between Sunni and Shia. And I think that's one reason al-Qaeda in Iraq is making a comeback in recent months.
What do you think should be done about all this?
Well, I think it's first and foremost incumbent on the Iraqi government to undermine the political support for al-Qaeda in Iraq by reaching out to moderate Sunni leaders and pulling them into an inclusive Iraqi government that can more effectively battle al-Qaeda.
What is the next step after these elections?
I think once the Iraqi leaders are elected, they must get together and work together. And they haven't done that too well over the last year. We've seen the Shiite-dominated Maliki government has put a premium on a sectarian agenda at the expense of the minority Sunnis and some of the Kurdish factions in the north. And I think Prime Minister Maliki needs to reach out and bring non-Shia political factions into his government in a more effective way.
Jim Phillips, Senior Research Fellow for Middle East Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. The election has already been postponed by several months in Anbar and Nineveh provinces because of security threats. Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad has resigned, ending a long-running dispute with President Mohammed Abbas. Before stepping down Saturday, Mr. Fayyad agreed to stay on as a caretaker prime minister until a new government is formed. Mr. Fayyad is credited with using international aid to build roads, schools, and other infrastructure in the West Bank. But he clashed with President Abbas over economic policy and his authority as prime minister. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuri. He called it a matter between Mr. Fayyad and the Fatah movement and has no connection to efforts at Palestinian reconciliation. Israeli cabinet spokesman Yaakov Peri says the issue does not directly impact the Israeli government.
It's an internal Palestinian issue. I don't think that Israel should interfere. I really hope that it will not delay our sincere intention to go back to the negotiation table.
Mr. Fayyad had received public support from U.S. leaders for his moderate approach to issues in the Middle East. Efforts are underway to improve the recently restored relations between Turkey and Israel. for some perspective on this effort and the impact of the civil war in Syria on those efforts. VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two analysts on VOA's Encounter program.
What are the many reasons behind the diplomatic rapprochement between Israel and Turkey, which U.S. President Barack Obama brokered during his recent visit to Jerusalem? What are the ramifications of this development for resolving the Syrian conflict and brokering peace between Israelis and Palestinians? Well, for more, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Soner Çaptay is a senior fellow and director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and that's a Washington-based policy group. And Matthew Duss, he's a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, also a policy group based here in Washington. Soner Çaptay, we know that Secretary of State John Kerry was just in Ankara. He was urging the Turks to make good on their commitments to normalize relations with Israel. We know that Israel apologized for the botched raid on the Gaza flotilla, which resulted in the loss of Turkish lives. They promised compensation. Where do things stand today?
Obviously, we're seeing a process of normalization, though remember that in the 1990s and earlier, Turkey and Israel had really good ties in many spheres, economic, security, military, intelligence. I don't think we're going to go back there anytime soon, but I think we're going to see a restoration of ties. Part of it is driven by the fact that both countries view Syria as an existential threat. They both have similar concerns, for example, the proliferation of chemical weapons owned by the regime. If they fall in wrong hands, they could be targeting Turkey. If they fall in the hands of PKK or PKK renegades, or in the case of Israelis, they fall in the hands of Hezbollah. So they're both seeing similar concerns. It's not surprising, therefore, that prior to normalization, there were military contacts between the two countries in 2011. Even though they did not supposedly have diplomatic ties, they actually had contacts to discuss how to contain the crisis in Syria. That's one aspect of normalization. And I think we will see them talk about and do stuff about Syria. This is going to be the first area of real cooperation. But another reason why I think we have seen rapprochement is because U.S. President Barack Obama took a personal interest in this. We know that he has really good relationship, personal and political, with Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan. This rapprochement really was nailed in the last minute of President Obama's visit to Israel. He called Erdogan with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu next to him while they were having kebabs, apparently. And he told him, he said, just, you know, take up this word and this is it. And I think Erdogan took the personal plea coming from Obama. And he basically decided that he would go ahead with it because, after all, the plea came from his friend, U.S. President Obama.
All right, back to you, Matt Duss, for your interpretation of the variety of reasons behind this acceleration of this rapprochement.
No, I think first the engagement of President Obama is key here. The timing is also key. Let's remember last year that we had the makings of an apology or a rapprochement like this that was torpedoed at the very last minute by Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Avigdor Lieberman is now sitting out of the Israeli government. He's in some legal trouble. So we have Netanyahu essentially acting as his own foreign minister without Lieberman there to do what Lieberman usually does. So he was able to take this opportunity. And in a very interesting situation, right there on a trailer on the tarmac, just as President Obama was out to leave the country. So going into the reasons, yes, I think Syria is clearly a reason for this. Another reason that hasn't really been reported as much is the issue of Israeli natural gas. Israeli made a very significant natural gas discovery. It just several weeks ago tapped the first of those wells. It's a considerable amount. A professor at Hebrew University estimated that this could account for as much as a third of Israel's GDP over the next several years. And looking at Israel's options for shipping out that natural gas and selling it, Turkey is a very, very obvious choice. There's Cyprus, there's Greece, but given the situation those two countries are in, that's obviously very touchy. So Turkey and Israel both stand to benefit a great deal if they can work some agreement for moving this natural gas from a pipeline through Turkey and then into Europe. So I think we have to pay attention to that as well.
So, Netchapta, do Turkey and Israel see eye to eye on Syria? Do their interests converge, or do they have any differences vis-a-vis how to resolve or at least cooperate on resolving this conflict?
I think this is one area in the region where the two countries have quite overlapping interests. You know, they don't agree on Iran. Israelis have suggested that it's ready to strike against Iran if necessary. Turkey is against any sort of military action, although it has joined the sanctions regime against Iran. The two countries don't agree on Palestinian politics. They will have other disagreements, but they do agree on Syria. They agree on Syria because a regime collapse in Syria that could produce a weak or failed state is something that's anathema to both, because it would be an unstable neighbor that could be producing all sorts of radicalizing groups that will be spreading that into the region. And the fact that the civil war is going to have ramifications in terms of what happens to Assad's chemical weapons, I think, shared concerns. So I would say if there was one area where I would look at Turkish-Israeli rapprochement producing results, that'd be Syria.
Sonar Chaptai, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Matthew Duss, policy analyst for the Middle East at the Center for American Progress, speaking on our Encounter program. You can hear their entire conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look for the Encounter under the Programs tab. Officials from the International Monetary Fund are hammering out terms of a much-needed infusion of cash for Egypt's weakening economy. VOA correspondent Elizabeth Errett reports from Cairo that some Egyptians are worried about foreign influence over Egypt in its current vulnerable state.
As Egypt's economy falters, its government is trying to find relief anywhere it can. Officials say they are closer to securing a nearly $5 billion package from the International Monetary Fund, while recently announcing a $3 billion bond deal with Qatar. As much as the foreign money is welcome, Egyptians worry about the lenders' motives. Some see the IMF as too close to the interests of Egypt's former government, and they view Qatar's largesse as prompted less by neighborly goodwill than by regional ambition. Economist Magdi Sobhi Youssef of the Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies.
التصور كما هي العادة في الحقيقة في أي جهة منحة للمساعدة أو المعونة.
Yusuf says it's normal for lenders or aid donors to have conditions that allow them to exploit the country they're helping, either through political concessions or the economy. He adds that's as true for the West as it is for Qatar and other Gulf nations. But economists say Egypt has the potential to build itself up without selling itself out. It starts, they argue, with ending the stalemate in domestic politics that has put meaningful reform on hold.
الاقتصار على الموضوع وكأن وصفة اقتصادية ستحل المشكلة سواء كان عبر الصندوق.
Yusuf says that to see the problem as something with only an economic solution will lead to failure. What's needed, he adds, is political harmony between the government and the opposition. One of the biggest sticking points in pushing through a reform program is the political fallout from austerity measures. Neither side appears to want to take the blame for cutting subsidies, a huge drain on the budget. In recent weeks, rising prices and shortages of diesel and cooking fuel have led to murderous rage. And historically, a boost in the cost of bread has led to riots across Egypt. But economists say there are ways to close loopholes so that only the far fewer truly needy get help. Amnea Helmi, director of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies, says while curtailing subsidies is important, it's only part of the answer.
It's not only about removing subsidies or lowering subsidies, but it's also about if people are offered or helped to have a good job with a decent salary, this would really alleviate their problem.
So too, she says, with the strategic use of aid from foreign countries to build Egypt's domestic economy.
When we get from the IMF the loan or from other donors, I don't want to see it all going only to finance the budget, but to other developmental projects that create jobs and improve the quality of life of Egyptians.
For all the concern about outside influence, the crumbling economy, and continuing political and security troubles, Helmi remains optimistic.
We are in a critical situation, but Egypt will not collapse. I'm confident. At the end of the day, Egyptians will make it.
Hers may be a minority view, based on a healthy dose of apolitical common sense. Other economists worry that the end of the day is still a long way off. Elizabeth Barrett, VOA News, Cairo.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.